This is Jeffrey Wells. You're listening to Hollywood Elsewhere. And this is our first sloppy ass, not quite good enough, but getting there podcast. So hang in there and the next one will be better. And then we'll start refining. And eventually the podcast will have the same refined aesthetic that I try and bring to the writing of this column. Anyway, this is a recording of a chat I had on Thursday afternoon, Thursday the 14th, with Jim Jarmusch, writer-director of Broken Flowers, a drama that is coming out in early August from Focus Features, a very good film in which Bill Murray plays a shut-down, sort of 50-ish type, emotionally shut down, socially shut down, shut down in almost every way you can be shut down, who is described by his next-door neighbor, very well played by Jeffrey Wright, as an ex-womanizer, kind of a Don Juan in his younger years. Anyway, it's about Murray going on this unhurried, very one-day-at-a-time journey of self-discovery when he receives a letter written on pink paper, significantly, from an anonymous woman claiming to be one of his ex-girlfriends, telling him he's got a son that he never knew he had, and that the son is starting to ask around about him, and so on. So Murray, curious, obviously, goes to visit four ex-girlfriends, played by Sharon Stone, Frances Conroy, Tilda Swinton, and Jessica Lange, to see which one may have written the letter and see what's up with the son. Broken Flowers is a curiously affecting film. It's one of those films that's tight and true and very well made, but it doesn't exactly, at least it didn't me, it didn't slam me across the chops and, you know, shake me by the lapels when I first saw it, but it does stay with you, and it gets better the more you think about it. I liked it, I admired it when I first saw it at Cannes. Now, in mid-July, like Gus Van Sant's Last Days also, I'm starting to think it's something else, a truly exceptional film, maybe even Jarmusch's best ever. I don't know that it's essential to ascertain all this stuff, but it's really quite good, and I'm looking forward to seeing it again. Anyway, here's the piece. I'm not going to be running interviews as long as this henceforth, but it'll be more like, 10, 12 minutes. This runs about 20 minutes. It happened at this really wonderful Italian eatery on Houston Street between Mott and Bulbury. Anyway, so without further ado, so I'll put the next podcast up sometime next week, I know it runs on too long. I know I'm going on too long right now, but just, bear with us, and we'll get better at this as we go along.
Economically, that's what America is.
Yeah.
I read a few weeks ago that the United States is, we borrow 80% of the rest of the world's savings to maintain our budget deficit.
Yeah.
When that reaches...
You mean just since the Bush administration?
Yes. Yeah. And that's rising, and if that hits like 90, 95%, the whole Ponzi scheme will collapse. The Chinese will say, well, we're not going to put the yuan connected to the dollar, we're going to connect it to the euro or whatever.
Right.
And it'll all fall down, But, I don't know. Americans are... There's a lot of sheeple here, But at the same time, they're manipulated. Like, I personally, I don't believe for a second that George Bush won the election. To me, that was doctored, just like the one before. Seems very obvious to me. So I really don't believe the religious right is the majority of Americans. I don't think the majority of Americans voted for Bush. Not that, in my opinion, Kerry was worth voting for, but I would have voted for Carrot Top, against Bush. But maybe that will change when there's an economic crisis, and maybe that's the only thing Americans can respond to is, oh shit, now I'm affected economically. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other subject. But it does, you know, it does follow, it has some connection to what you're talking about, this kind of complacent, lackadaisical, you know, people just seem sort of zombified to a large degree. I don't know what they're interested in. And yet, you know what, I don't know, when you read like what's on the bestseller list, that alone should indicate, well, maybe it's just the people who support Bush don't read, I don't know. But by any indication of bestsellers, the way majority of people who read books are certainly not, they don't support this whole administration and this whole, well, I don't know, the Fourth Reich or whatever it is, I don't even know anymore.
I got too deeply into this tangent, but isn't having the literacy level pretty much steadily declining?
Less in America, yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, in Argentina, they have a 98% literacy rate. In Cuba, they have over 98% literacy. And that's Cuba, where we're always told, you know, yeah, I'm not defending Cuba. Just, you know, it's just a fact.
Right.
And everybody has health care there.
Right.
You know, so wait, what is this? What is all this for? This culture, you know.
What is the literacy rate supposed to be here?
I don't know. I thought it was like in the low 70%. It might even be lower. I'm not sure.
That's interesting. That economic thing that you mentioned. Can you give me the source of that, or where I can look it up, or just is, you know, are borrowing that much money of some savings of other countries, particularly the Asian markets and all that? I mean, I know that's true, but the way you put it was very concise.
Yeah, I heard it on someone being interviewed on, I think on NPR, but I've also read reference to that in Paul Krugman's writing, you know. Might have come from Paul Krugman, I'm not sure, but I've been reading him for years, and everything he says everything he predicts keeps coming true, so I don't know if he's, you know, they say he's a left-wing nut job, he's a very, and who's that other incredible economist from Harvard University? He was the youngest Harvard tenured professor when he was like 27, and he just wrote a book about ending world poverty, and he's like this brilliant economist. Anyway, I don't know shit about economics, but I read Paul Krugman more, and I always read the New York Times business section always, because to me that's where you really see what's going on. Like, if you just read the business section, you get a much more clear political overview of how the world, what's going on. You know, and I always read the business section and the international business section, and my friends are always like, "Why are you reading that? Yeah, you don't give a shit about business." I know, but I care about the world, and that's how I find out what the hell's going on. Depending on how they like to work, rehearsal or not, discussion or not, And what we try to do is collaborate on a character that I've already written and imagined, but they are going to embody. So I want them to, you know, obviously I want to work with them for that character. So they have qualities that, you know, are going to elevate that character above my imagination. And then what we try to do is work toward understanding the character on a reactive as someone reacting, not as acting out something that I wrote. So when I do rehearse, I don't rehearse scenes in the script. I rehearse scenes that aren't in the script, because that I just invent on the spot, so that we start understanding that our procedure is one of reaction and not acting. And then with the dialogue, once we feel like we have a character that we could take anywhere, take them to the pizza stand, take them into a bar, have them be that character or her, then we start filming. And because of that, if that collaboration, if they want to vary the dialogue somewhat, I'm very open to that, because it means they are, their character is incorporating how they would say something. In this film, I wanted that, I'm always open to that. It happened a little less than usual because the actors kept saying, no, I like the dialogue. Mm-hmm. So what could I say? Like, well, I thought you'd come up with something better, you know? So we didn't improvise as much as I usually like to leave it open to. I mean, Bill came up with little things here and there. All of them did, but a little less, though, than in, maybe in my other films. But they still follow the procedure, which was, we know who this person is, we think, and now this happens to them, and they react to it. So, but acting really is about reacting, not acting out somebody's script. And when I see that on screen, I get very, I don't know, I find it annoying, like when they're obviously acting out the intention of the story.
Right.
So.
Or doesn't it have to, be some instigator of the, emotional and dramatic import? I mean, there has to be someone acting something so that the other people or person can react and do that, right? Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, in any given situation, we're talking here. I say something, you react. You say something, I react. That's just how people communicate. But it's not set up so, like in a film, we're acting out a scene that's already written, so we know how it's going to end and what we're supposed to say. And if we just start, if that's our focus, then we're just acting our way through it. Whereas if, it's written that you say, you speak first, so then I react. But still, the general tone of how we work should be that of reactivity and not of trying to express something in the script to some imaginary audience that isn't even there on the set, you know? So all we have is our own selves, and it's still reactive, no matter who's the more aggressive character or who's more dramatic. I mean, I still think that holds true, that as soon as your brain starts thinking I am acting it out, then we lost some thread of what we're trying to do. I don't know how to explain it any better. I'm just learning. You know, I learn every film, every actor I learn something new from. I learn another way to collaborate. So it's still an open process for me. It's not like I have an answer, I have a formula that I know works. It's just I know certain elements that will help us get to something collaboratively, you know. So I try to work on that and take it from there, and then each actor is different and has different insights, different life experiences, different experiences as an actor, and a different way to approach any character. So I got to find out what that is for them and then work with them to get to this place. So I'm still, I'm not a master of directing acting. I'm learning it. And it was a lot of fun on this one because I learned a lot from a variety of actors.
You know, it's funny, I was talking about the culture of the South and just the atmosphere of the South. And I took a drive deep into Mississippi and Alabama once. I remember the moss hanging from the trees and everything. But I was just saying to somebody, I said, down by law, the swamps, there's a lot of quiet, as I remember in that film. There was just nice, you know. And I, that's one of the more genuine things. It's interesting that, you know, a New Yorker like yourself, you really got something. I really, really love that.
Thanks. That's whatever I'm trying
to describe here. But I thought it was honest. I thought it was something that I wasn't getting. You know, we were talking about all this, the redneck films that were so popular in the 70s, which are all cliches about small towns, like corrupt sheriff and the Daisy May girlfriend and the Kizmo and driving the fast cars and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Dukes of Hazzard coming out, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Muscle cars. The girl with the big tits and really short shorts on.
Right. It's all pretty much corporate-fit cliches that... See, this is what's distressing about people. They obviously like this shit, or they wouldn't keep making them. They wouldn't make them because if they didn't think that they're going to sell tickets. This is the odd thing about American culture. People eat this shit up.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody else earlier about reality shows. That's just the worst crap. I can't even imagine spending 3 minutes of wasting 3 minutes of my time watching that stuff.
Like Survivor and the...
all that stuff. Fear Factor or whatever the hell they are. I can't even imagine watching that kind of stuff. What is it? It's like the lowest common denominator. And do people really like it?
Mm.
I don't know. Or is it just what's fed to them and they're accustomed to having it fed? I mean, I think a lot of Hollywood is feeding things to people because they're very timid in Hollywood. They're very gutless. They're not. They have to have their little formula of the marketing analysis. And I really think they'd make more money if they tried some different things and got a more wider scope out there. Why not? But, our marketing analysis. And it's never right anyway, you know? I was watching that show about George Stevens last night. It was a profile on NET of director George Stevens.
Was it the old documentary called The Filmmaker's Journey?
Yes.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
His son did it.
And what were we just talking about?
Reality television, corporate fed cliches about...
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was saying that they analyzed Chain, and they said, an Alan Ladd film's never grossed more than this amount, so it's not going to gross more than this amount, so we're trying to sell it to Howard Hughes, and he was going to buy it for too much,
and
then he dumped out, and now we're stuck.
Yeah.
And then it was a huge grossing film, which means they don't know shit about what their marketing analysis doesn't mean shit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they cling to it like little pussies, you know? Like, well, no, don't want to do that. And that's the biggest problem I have with Hollywood. I don't have a problem with films are commerce and we got to do this, you know?
Right.
And there are a lot of Hollywood films I love, and big budget films. I'm not against the nature of commercial cinema, but I really find it insulting to any viewer, this kind of just dumbing everything down because that's what they tell us we want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're just too terrified of taking any little chance. And no businessmen, you know, make huge scores without taking a chance. You know what I mean? So I don't know. That's what I find wrong with Hollywood. Not that it's a commercial form. I mean, so is pop music. You know what I mean? And that's given me some of the greatest gifts I can imagine.
Sure.
But I just find that they're so timid. It's kind of funny. They're very, very afraid of stepping out of the niche, you know? Which I think they'd make a lot more money if they had a little courage.
Definitely.
So I don't know if it's what we want or just that's what we're told we want and that's what we're going to get. And people are like, okay, we'll take the Dukes of Hazzard then.
You ever see Lamont Johnson's film, 73, it's called The Last American Hero?
No.
Based on the Tom Wolfe Esquire piece. Junior Johnson is the last American hero, yes. One of his great pieces about this guy who used to run, literally it's the granddaddy, the grandfather of this type of movie. A guy who literally used to try to escape from the cops, moving moonshine in the back roads, and got to know how to drive that way, and became a example, I felt that that was real Americana, or at least much more real than what is commonly their stuff. And I'm trying to make a point that I think that your way of doing things, I would like to see you go into other cultures and do things that are outside your natural, comfortable realm, which is, you know, Bill Murray's kind of a comfortable realm for you. Coffee and cigarettes suits you. But I love the idea of you going into things that aren't you naturally, because you tend to find things that are, you know, for want of a better term, I believe your stuff when you go outside your realms. And,
yeah.
You know, it's that aesthetic that you bring to things.
Yeah, although for me, this film was outside my realm in a weird way, because I don't identify with the character at the beginning of the film. And when I finished the script, which I wrote really fast and read it through, I was like, why do you want to even make a film about this kind of a guy? I don't know. I like the story, so I'm going to go forward. But it seemed. But I know what you're saying. I mean, and I think I agree with you. But I don't plan. I'm not very calculating, so I just kind of follow inspiration and intuition without making a real plan. But
how fast?
Script, so 2.5 weeks.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I had the ideas. I was carrying them around for a year, you know, 6 years. Little ideas here and there. But then I sat down and I wrote it real fast. And I didn't rewrite it. I only rewrite each night before we shoot. I will rewrite a scene, you know, or work on it the night before. But I don't really, I don't like laboring on the script, because it's just a map anyway, you know. But we stayed pretty close to it, oddly enough.
So you kind of wrote it in what one could call it, like maybe a Neil Cassidy or Jack Kerouac rush.
It's pretty fast, yeah. I just kept writing each day. I'd write for 5-6 hours a day, and then 5 hours maybe then.
How do you write again? By hand or?
I write by hand in notebooks, and then I'll stop and listen to music and carry around a little recorder and make some notes that I'm not going to write till the next day.
Right.
So that I don't have to, you know, so my mind can just drift around on things out of order. And then I collect those details the next day and work them in or whatever.
Right.
But I don't even write in order always. Sometimes I'll write a scene that I have an idea for that I kind of know. I mean, I have a big piece of plywood that I put note cards on.
Right.
So I try to look at the overview of the film's scenes. But sometimes when I'm writing and I'll have that board, it's like, I've written the first 5 scenes, but scene 16 is coming to me, so I write that then. And I, you know, so it doesn't always come in continuity.
Right.